So let us continue again where we left off. So we have just been looking at the unwholesome motivations, the unwholesome things that drive us to act. And now we're going to look at the counterparts, which are the wholesome motivations that also drive us to act as well. So this is very useful. So now we're going to look at the more positive side of things. The suttas are always built up in this way, right? It's always kind of, you see one side of the coin and see the other side of the coin. And this is, one of the reasons why they often seem so repetitive for that reason. So this is how it goes. There are bhikkhus, these three wholesome roots or skillful roots. What three? The skillful or wholesome root that is non-greed. That is wholesome root non-anger, and the wholesome root non-delusion. And of course, this means, the non-greed means really, one of the main meanings of that is generosity. It also means just absence of greed as such, but generosity is obviously a very important part of that. It's the opposite of being greedy. The opposite of anger, of course, is to have metta, sense of kindness to other people, sense of care. Right? Non-anger, but also metta is an important part of that. And then non-delusion, which is really clarity, which is like vipassana, insight, understanding, seeing things in the right way is the opposite of that. Okay. So, whatever non-greed occurs, bhikkhus, is wholesome, is skillful. Whatever action one without greed performs by body, speech, and mind is also wholesome. When one without greed, not overcome by greed, with mind not obsessed by it, does not inflict suffering upon another under a false pretext by killing, imprisonment, confiscation, taking, censure, banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is wholesome or skillful. Thus the numerous wholesome qualities originate in him, born of non-greed, non-desire, non-craving, caused by non-desire, arisen from non-craving, conditioned by non-greed. So here we have the exact opposite, and this tells us a lot about why the cultivation of the mind is so important in Buddhism, because the mind is always the source of everything. The mind is where the problem starts. You know that famous verse in the Dhammapada where it says that the mind is forerunner of all phenomena, just like the cart follows the ox, the hoof of the ox, in the same way all phenomena follows the state of the mind, right? Same kind of idea here. And this is why the cultivation of the mind is so important. Learning how to think and reflect in a useful way is an extraordinarily important part of the Buddhist path. So we can move away from the anger and the negativity and the desires and look at the world in such a way that we can have compassion and kindness instead. And it is surprising, this is not actually that difficult to do. And this is one of the things that I will talk about later on in this retreat. So don't leave the retreat too early. You're going to miss out on all of these nice things, right? So there's so much nice stuff in the suttas. Whatever you do, you're going to get much benefit. But anyway, we're going to talk about those things later on because they are so useful and so important on the Buddhist path. The cultivation of the mind, reflecting in the right way, so important to be able to get this whole thing working in the right way. And then, of course, by doing that, the greed starts to disappear, non-greed arising instead, right? You want to be generous, you want to do all of those right things. And then everything good comes from that. What a wonderful thing that is. And of course, exactly the same then with the other wholesome qualities. Whatever non-anger occurs is wholesome, is skillful. Whatever actions are without anger, without ill will, performed by body, speech, and mind, is also wholesome. When one without anger, not overcome by anger, with mind not obsessed by it, does not inflict suffering upon another under a false pretext, that too is wholesome. The numerous wholesome qualities originate in him, born of non-anger, originate by non-ill will, arisen from non-hatred, conditioned by non-ill will and anger. And of course, a mind state that is without anger is precisely the mind state of metta. And this is one of the reasons why we try to do some metta meditation on the Buddhist path, because it is the exact opposite of these negative states. And it's an important, very important part of the idea of non-anger here. Whatever non-delusion occurs is wholesome, is skillful. Whatever deed one who is undeluded performs by body, speech, and mind is also wholesome. When one is not deluded, not confused, not overcome by confusion and delusion, with mind not obsessed by it, does not inflict suffering upon another under a false pretext, that too is wholesome. Thus numerous wholesome qualities originate in him, born of non-delusion, caused by non-confusion, arisen from non-delusion, conditioned by non-delusion and non-confusion. So all of these wholesome things arising when we do things in the right way. And again, the point here is that the only real way to know whether you are doing something wholesome and unwholesome, the final way of knowing that, the ultimate test for these things, is to look at the motivation in your mind. Right? That is the final test. The final test is not the act itself. Too many moral systems in the world, there are a system that tells you, you shall not do this, you shall do that. In Buddhism, it is far more nuanced than that, far more carefully divided. It is not so much, these things are always wrong. It depends on your mind state. It depends on your motivation. The motivation is ultimately what makes things wrong or right, not the actual act as such. Where are you coming from really matters. I look more at this when we come to the actual sila part later on. And for now, just keep that at the back of your mind so you have some idea of these things. Suppose a tree was choked and enveloped by three maluva creepers. Then a man would come along bringing a shovel and a basket. He would cut down the creepers at their roots, dig them out, pull out the roots, even the fine rootlets and the root fiber. He would cut the creepers into pieces, split the pieces, and reduce them to slivers. Then he would dry the slivers in the wind and sun, burn them in a fire, reduce them to ashes, and winnow the ashes in a strong wind, or let them be carried away by the swift current of a river. This is what we're supposed to do with the defilements, right? Split them into small pieces, reduce them to slivers, dry them and burn them. We want to really destroy these defilements in a serious way, no messing around, until we cut out even the fine rootlets, right? The fine root fibers. We get rid of that. Every little, last little bit and piece of these defilements, we want to remove them. This is what the Buddha basically is saying here. In this way, those maluva creepers would be cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that they are no more subject to future arising. So the idea here is to end these defilements in the same way that this maluva creeper is ended. This maluva creeper has no chance of regrowing. Made like a palm stump. When you cut off the top of a palm tree, right, it doesn't grow anymore, because those palm trees would have, and then have a crown on top, cut off the crown, and they die as a consequence. This is what is going on here. Like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, obliterated, right? It's a very strong, strong word. So too, Bhikkhu, such a person has abandoned the bad, unwholesome qualities born of desire, born of anger, ill will, born of confusion and delusion, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, obliterated them so that they are no more subject to future arising. He dwells happily in this very life, without distress, anguish, or fever. And in this very life he attains Nibbana. These are the three wholesome roots. So this is what happens if you develop those wholesome roots all the way to the end. you end up attaining Nibbana. And in fact, that is the definition of Nibbana in the suttas. It is always defined as the ending of the three unwholesome roots, completely being cut off. That is actually the one that is defined as. Sometimes people think Nibbana is about the kind of a state that you experience after you die, that kind of stuff. But not really. It just means that your mind is free of these things. Remember, Nibbana means extinguishment. It means that something has been removed. Something has been extinguished in your mind. And this is what has been extinguished. So it's just like your experience now, except that there is no more defilements in the mind, right? And then, that is when you are happy. You are, says here, that he dwells happily in this very life without distress, anguish and fever. In this very life you attain Nibbana. So, there you are, the little sutta on the three unwholesome motivations. And I think it is a very important sutta because it drives home what real ethics is according to the Buddha's teachings. Now I want to move on to the next sutta, which is on page 20. This sutta is called the Dog Duty Ascetic, the Kukravattika Sutta in Pali, found in the Majjhima Nikaya 57. And it's a long sutta. It's actually a very nice sutta in many ways. The Buddha meets with these two people who are ascetics. And they have a strange ascetic behavior. One is living like a dog, and the other one is living like an ox. Right? And they walk around completely naked, crawling around on all fours, eating the food off the ground, and then curling up at night to sleep like a dog, right? This is how they live their life. And the idea is that if you live your life like that, it's quite funny, isn't it? And when you live like that, eventually you go to heaven because you live like a dog like that. That's kind of the idea behind these things. And then, of course, they ask the Buddha. They see the Buddha. Here is a real holy man, brother. Let's ask the Buddha, see what he has to say about this. And then the Buddha says, if you live like a dog like that, there's only two outcomes right in the future life of living like a dog. Outcome number one, guess what? You become a dog in a future life, right? Why? Because you are developing the feeling of being like a dog. You're developing the dog mind. So if you develop the dog mind, that's where you go in a future life, because your mind is already like a dog in a sense. Or because you have a wrong view and you're doing all kinds of stupid things, it can be even worse, and you can actually be reborn even worse than a dog, right? So the dog is like the good destination. If you practice the dog mind, that's the best thing you can do. Or it can be even worse than that. And then they start crying, right? Oh, no! They cry. What? They say, we're doing all this hard work, right? It's not going anywhere. Okay, so thank you very much, Buddha. Now we know what we have to do, and they kind of get on the right track. And the funny thing is that I think if you go to India in the present day, you still find people like that in India. It's what I've been saying all along. India, nothing has changed over 2,500 years, right? Still, you see these kind of things happening in India, which is kind of fascinating because it really makes you believe, yes, there actually were these kind of ascetics in India 2,500 years ago. It's almost hard to believe, but actually, yes, they probably were there. Anyway, so after the Buddha has then shown them that the danger of living like an ox and living like a dog is not really recommended, then he has this other teaching, which actually is very interesting, and it's only found in a few places in the suttas. And this is also about karma and action and how to understand the idea of karma in a useful way. And this is what this sutta is about. And it goes as follows. Punna, I think, is the dog duty or the ox, maybe the ox duty, yes, I can't remember now. Punna, there are four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. What are the four? There is dark action with dark result. There is bright action with bright result. There is dark and bright action with dark and bright result. And there is action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the end of action. And what, Punna, is dark action with dark result? Here, someone makes afflictive karma with the body. Afflictive means like causing suffering for other people, right? You make afflictive karma by the body, afflictive karma by speech, afflictive karma by mind. having made this afflictive kamma by the body, the afflictive kamma by mind, the afflictive kamma by mind, he reappears in an afflictive world. When he has reappeared in an afflictive world, afflictive, in other words, painful contacts touch him. Being touched by painful contacts, he feels painful feelings, exclusively painful, as in the case of the beings in hell. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called dark action with dark result. Right? So be careful of those dark actions because they end up having bad consequences. And one of the interesting things about this is how does this actually work? Why is it that dark actions have such dark results? And it's not that difficult to understand why this must be the case. And if you look at yourself and you look at the effect that your own actions has on your mind, I would say each one of us, we have the ability to see what is going on here. When you do something bad, right, feel what it feels like when you do something bad. And if you are careful and you're not kind of too much involved with just looking at the object of your, you know, maybe you're angry or something, but you actually feel what is happening inside of you instead, you will feel that when you do something bad, you tend to feel bad about it. You're dragging yourself down. This is how karma works. I think I talked about this before, but it's worthwhile repeating here. You feel actually the badness inside of you. And the more bad things you accumulate, the more bad actions you do, body, speech, and mind, the more you drag yourself down. You make your mind into a dark, unpleasant place to be. And of course, if you keep on doing these things, the more you do that, then when you die, you accumulate all of these things. Your mind is in a dark spot. Where does the dark mind go? Well, it goes to a bad destination. It's already in a bad destination. It just continues on in that bad destination in the new life. Right? This is kind of natural. Whereas the exact opposite is also true. You do something kind, you feel uplifted by that, you feel happy that you have done an act of generosity, it lifts you up. The more you do of those good actions, the more you accumulate that, the more you lift yourself up, right? The more helium you fill into that balloon, so the balloon soars, your mind soars very high. And then when you die, your mind is already lifted up. And because you're already in a good destination, it continues in that good destination when you pass away. This is what we mean by the creation of karma. There's nothing really magical about it at all. You can see this creation of karma right here in this life, and then you know that that mind state will then continue also in the future life. It's quite straightforward, right? Once you get your head around these things, the kind of the popular ideas of karma are often much harder to understand, right? You do good in this life, you get a BMW in your next life. That is not so obvious how that works, right? But if you do good and you feel good, it makes much more sense. Of course, getting a BMW can feel good. That can be part of that. But it's only subsidiary. It's not the main issue. So that is kind of the point here. Okay, so that is dark action with dark results. And as you can see here, we're talking about people being reborn in hell. So it is, these are really dark actions, right? With really, really dark results. And what is the opposite? What puna is bright action with bright result? Here someone makes an unafflictive, a happy action with the body. That makes other people feel happy. Unafflictive action by speech and unafflictive action by mind. Having made an unaffliction action by body, by speech and by mind, they reappear in an unafflictive, in a happy world. Just as I was saying a second ago. When he has appeared in an unafflicted happy world, he is touched by happy contacts. When he's touched by happy contacts, he feels happy feelings, exclusively pleasant, as in the case of the gods of refulgent glory. Yes, it's kind of a Subhakinna Deva is the Pali word, and this refers to the devas that are reborn in the third jhana realm. That's what it refers to specifically here. And of course, that is the highest kind of happiness that you can have in samsara. There is no experience, pure experience of happiness beyond that. Once you go beyond that, you feel even better, but it's no longer happiness you feel, it is neutrality, which is even better than happiness. But this is the highest kind of pleasant feeling you can have, right? The state, the gods of the Subhakinna gods. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called bright action with bright result. And again, you can see here that the bright action here is really incredibly bright. It means you get reborn in the third jhana realm, way, way up there, you know, the very higher kind of points of samsara. So we're talking about incredibly bright action. This is the kind of action that you do after you come out of a jhana state, when all the defilements of the mind are far gone for a long period of time afterwards. That's kind of action we're talking about. It's very rare to find people in the world who are able to do this kind of actions, because most of us don't have minds that are quite that pure. It is rare to find this kind of people. So that leaves an interesting question. What about all the people, all the beings in between? Now we have looked at the hell realms, we have looked at the third jhana, but there's a lot of beings in between there. This is kind of the brightest and the darkest, and this is what comes next. All the beings in between these two extremes. And what puna is dark and bright action with dark and bright result. Here someone makes kamma by the body that is both afflictive and unafflictive. Makes kamma by the body that is both speech, that is both afflictive and unafflictive. Makes kamma by mind that is both afflictive and unafflictive. Having made kamma by body, speech and mind that is both afflictive and unafflictive, that person reappears in the world that is both afflictive and unafflictive. When he reappears there, contacts that are both afflictive and unafflictive touch him, and then he feels feelings that are both afflictive and unafflictive, mingled pleasure and pain, as in the case of human beings and some of the gods and some beings in the lower world. Right? Thus a being's reappearance is due to a being. When reappears through the actions one has performed, when one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called dark and bright action with dark and bright result. So now you know why you have been reborn as a human, right? This is why we have all been reborn as human beings, because we did actions in the past that were both afflictive and unafflictive. So what does this mean? And what this means, as I understand this, and this is where kind of the what I would call the natural understanding of the suttas, and sometimes the understanding you find in places like the Abhidhamma is maybe a little bit at odds, because the Abhidhamma would interpret this as you do actions that are bright and actions that are dark, but quickly kind of changing between the one and the other, right? But I don't think this is the meaning of this, because if that was the meaning, that would mean that we would experience feelings as human beings that are either very happy or very dark, back and forth very quickly. That would be the result of that kind of action according to this. But we know that what it feels like to be a human being, it feels most of the time like we are somewhere in between, right? Neither is it incredibly depressive or sad, nor is it extremely happy most of the time. Most of the time we're kind of somewhere in the middle there. That is kind of the human experience. And sometimes we feel more happy, sometimes we feel a bit depressed and sad, so it's a bit up and down, but the average is somewhere in the middle there. Right? And so what is the action that leads to this? And so these dark and bright actions often mean that our motivations are not entirely pure. Our motivations, nor are they entirely impure. Our motivations are somewhere in the middle there. Right? So when you do an act in ordinary life, neither are you being very generous, nor are you being very greedy. But your mind state is somewhere in between. And this is, I think, a lot of the actions that we do as human beings are that kind of actions, motivated by things that are kind of slightly neutral in the middle there. But even when we try to do actions that are kind, like say we try to be generous, if you are generous, it's very rare that that generosity is absolutely pure, right? That it comes from this wanting to give to the whole world with complete purity inside. Very often we give. We are trying to be as kind and as generous as we possibly can, but it doesn't come from that incredible purity inside. We are rather trying to learn how to be generous in the right way. We are still generous, which always is a good thing to do, but not coming from that absolute purity inside. And this is one of those important things to remember, that when we practice the spiritual path, we don't try to be perfect straight away. We realize that there are limitations on how kind and how generous and how compassionate we can be. We just do our best. And by doing our best, you gradually learn to build things up and to do things in a more pure way. It takes time. It often takes years to learn these things, but it is one of those investments that is really, really, really worthwhile in this life. Because here, you get profound, deep-seated results inside of you that changes your entire outlook, and your entire life is transformed as a consequence. So this is the idea here. Our motivations are kind of mixed, right? There's a little bit of this, a little bit of that there, and it's not entirely pure. We know that we're doing the right thing, but we're trying to move in the right direction. This is the idea of dark and bright actions. And this is very useful, as we shall see later on, to remember this, because it means that we have a way of understanding karma and actions in ordinary life. We know the precepts, for example, about not killing. And then we start to understand that, well, the idea of killing or not killing comes in many different shades of grey. There is the very, very bad killing, which is killing somebody because you hate them or because you are greedy and you want something from that person. That is an extraordinarily bad way of killing somebody, because it's coming from very powerful, unwholesome motivation inside of you. At the other end, there might be somebody who is very close to death, and they say, oh, I've had enough, I really don't want to live anymore, my body is falling apart, it's absolute misery, please help me to get out of this suffering, right? And then you look into your heart and you find out, well, actually, I would really like to help this person because they've had enough, whatever, and maybe you turn off some machine that is keeping them alive, right? In that sort of situation, if you are coming from compassion, if you're coming from wisdom, the karma that you're making is a very, very different kind. In that situation, you might even be making good karma, right? Because you are actually helping the person to overcome suffering. You're not coming from a bad motivation, but a good motivation. It's not really called killing anyway. If you do that kind of thing, I wouldn't even call that killing. Because killing is depriving something that somebody wants to have. If you don't really want to live anymore, you're not really depriving them of anything, so it hardly call it killing at that particular point. But the point is that an action can be so varied depending on why you are doing something, right? And this is really kind of the crucial issue here. And in between that, there can be all kinds of shade of grey, right? Of why you kill somebody, why you are generous, why you steal, why you are doing an act of kindness, all kinds of shade of grey. And because there are all kinds of shade of grey, what we should aim for in life is to move towards the lighter shades of grey. You should never really aim for the completely pure action unless you are a saint already. So maybe some saints here, I'm not sure. I'm looking around to see if I can see any saints. If you are very saintly already, great. Please act on that saintliness. But for most people, we just move a little bit towards the lighter shades of grey, right? Doing things a little bit better. Doing things a bit better than we did before. And we avoid the darker shades of grey. And as we do that, we're heading in the right direction. This is what it is really often is about, because that absolute purity is impossible for us. And this also shows that one of the questions that I very often get as a monk is, people come to me and say, oh, is this bad karma or is it good karma, right? An action. And very often, the fact that you are in doubt whether something is good or bad karma usually means you cannot classify action in that way, either bad or good. Usually it's somewhere in the middle, and that's why you're having doubts in the first place, right? Because it's somewhere in the middle there. So in this way, it's very useful to think about karma in this way, because it means we go away from this simplistic idea of karma, either good or bad. Actually, very often it's somewhere in between, and we move towards the brighter things instead. So this is the message of the sutta. I think it's a very useful message, because the ideas of karma, in my opinion, are often quite misunderstood very often, and we often go by quite simplistic ideas what karma is all about. So let us have a look at the very last one. And what puna is action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright results? Action that leads to the end of action. Therein, the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark results. The volition for abandoning the kind of action that is bright with bright results. And the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark and bright with dark and bright result. This is called action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright results, action that leads to the end of action. So this is the kind of action that you have when you realize for the first time that you don't really want to be reborn again, right? You don't want to go on in this samsaric existence. And when you then act upon that, you act through insight, you act by practicing the path, you act by attaining samadhi, you act by doing all of these kind of things, because you want to make an end of this. That is actually what this is about. So this is when you become, ideally, when you become an Arya, a noble one, a stream enterer, or whatever it is, that is when you see the Dhamma in that way, and you don't want to do that kind of action anymore. That is where this is coming from. This is a very difficult kind of thing to do. It is only really the Aryans who are able to do these kind of action, because only they understand the problem of rebirth fully. For the rest of us, it's still a little bit uncertain. Okay, then he says, these are the four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. So that there is for you another summary about how, and a background, if you like, about how action actually works, and how it kind of gives us a bit of a framework. And once we have this framework, once you understand the idea of motivation, right, which was the previous sutta, how motivation is the basis for all action, and then also understanding how motivation is often very complex, and often it is often colored by all kind of things, colored by defilements, colored by conflicts of interest, right? And all of these kind of things. For example, you may be compassionate to one person and not to another one, and it gets very complicated, the reason, the way we actually do actions for this reason. And when you do it in this, when we have this background, then it is much more easy to understand later on the ethics of the Buddhist path. Anyway, that is enough for now. So have a nice lunch, and then we will see you back again at 2 o'clock here.